At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
So, the Council of Economic Advisers, those people with the president's ear, what do they actually do anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Lizzie O'Leary, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, December 26. Thanks for being with us. We are going to start with the Trump presidential transition. This weekend, President-elect Donald Trump said he would dissolve his charitable foundation to resolve potential conflicts of interest. That could be harder than it sounds, though, since the foundation is currently under investigation by the New York Attorney General. A spokeswoman for that office says Trump can't dissolve the foundation until the investigation is over. Meanwhile, there is the question of who will advise the president-elect on economics. That role is filled by the Council of Economic Advisers. Unlike the Fed or Treasury Department, the CEA doesn't make policy. It's more a brain trust with the president's ear. We asked a few people who have done this job how it works and what might change under Trump. Marketplace's Adam Allington starts us off.
The best way to explain what members of the Council of Economic Advisers actually do is to think of them as the president's personal think tank. They look at data, run analysis, and then advise him on policies that might find fertile ground.
The job of a good CEA, like the job of a good gardener, is 10% planting seeds and 90% pulling weeds.
Austin Goolsbee is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, as well as a former chair of the CEA under Barack Obama. Because the council is more analytical than political, Goolsbee says one of its important roles is blocking bad ideas from rising to the top.
They go around and say, wait a minute, this idea doesn't make any sense, you know, as wacky stuff comes down the pipe.
Since the council doesn't have any explicit authority within government, the CEA's influence is largely based on the chairman's relationship with the president. Peter Ferrara is a fellow at the Heartland Institute, a free market think tank.
The council is very powerful because they can talk directly to the president. That's always the most important thing in government.
Ferrara, who worked under President Reagan, says the Trump administration could stand to include more pro-business voices on the council.
They need a council that is going to follow the same pro-growth economic formula that Reagan did.
Still, others push back and say the council's role has never been to advocate policy, a big reason CEA economists usually come from places without a policy bent, says Laura Tyson, an economist and former chair of the CEA under President Clinton.
The issues they're coming from tend to be apolitical or non-political or bipartisan or, you know, university. So there isn't a kind of partisan standard.
Tyson says it would be a problem if the council becomes more of a platform for punditry than analysis. At this point, Trump hasn't announced who he'll appoint as chairman. Whoever that person is will need approval by the Senate. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Restaurants and grocery stores produce tons of food waste right now, this period of time between Thanksgiving and New Year's. Some app developers have taken note and want to change that and also make a little money while doing it. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
David Rodriguez started looking into food waste for a graduate school project.
When you're able to see the amount of food that has been wasted is whenever you want to do something about it.
And that's a lot of waste. According to the environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council, we throw out about 40% of the food produced here. The tab, $165 billion. Rodriguez says he came up with an idea that had so much traction at school, it got picked up by a local incubator, and they built an app. He's calling it Food for All, and he says the biggest obstacle right now is changing the way people think about food in America.
It's a cultural thing. Trying to make a change in the way people consider reducing the amount of food waste.
The way the app works is you log on, enter your location, and see what participating restaurants are offering. It's extra food they couldn't sell and would have thrown out. They'd sell it to you at a 50 to 80% discount. Tova Danovich is a food journalist in Portland, Oregon. She says right now, activists are trying to get people to buy quote-unquote ugly produce, apples and carrots that look a little odd. And even that is slow in catching on.
So when you look at that as just kind of the first step to getting Americans thinking about food in a different way, having them buy leftovers from a stranger is a giant leap.
For restaurants, for example, a downside could be that it gives people an incentive to wait and buy their food on the cheap. Nicole Savita is director of the Food Recovery Project at the University of Arkansas.
I think there's just some practical concerns.
She says using technology to connect restaurants that have extra food with people who are looking for deals is a good idea.
But if there aren't a whole lot of restaurants involved and there aren't a whole lot of people signed up to use the app, I wonder sort of whether there's any sort of efficient economy of scale involved with it.
David Rodriguez is looking to launch Food for All in Boston and New York. He's raising money through Kickstarter and is hoping to roll out the app early next year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Drug-resistant infections can seem like an abstract problem, but 700,000 people around the world die from them every year. That's prompted the United Nations to hold a forum recently on how to deal with drug resistance. And if the human toll isn't reason enough to do that, there's an economic one, too. A World Bank report spells out a worst-case scenario where resistance to antibiotics could cause global economic damage on par with the 2008 financial crisis. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains.
Antibiotics are the linchpin of modern medicine, but their overuse has led to the development of microbes that are resistant to them. Ramanan Lakshminarayan directs the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy. He says drug resistance is poorly quantified, but a big deal.
People don't understand that when someone dies of a multi-organ failure in a hospital, that was because the antibiotics didn't work for them.
The World Bank's Tim Evans says the overuse of antibiotics as growth promoters in livestock production is also causing problems.
And this is really fostering the development of superbugs.
Evans says superbug infections in humans and animals threaten to push up health care costs and decrease the labor supply and livestock production. The World Bank says by 2050, those combined effects could, in a worst-case scenario, slash nearly 4% off annual global GDP.
The bulk of that would be concentrated in low-income countries. That would mean an additional 28 million people falling into extreme poverty by 2050.
To avoid that dire outcome, better antibiotic stewardship is needed, according to Elizabeth Youngman at the Pew Charitable Trusts. She says we need pharmaceutical companies to come up with new antibiotics, but not market them heavily.
You really kind of want to lock those in the medicine cabinet and wait until you really need them to use them.
Leaders at the United Nations are making a push for all that to happen so that drug resistance does not reach the worst-case scenario. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Markets were closed for the holidays, so we're going to get outdoorsy later. Details when we do the numbers. Stretch to say that 2016 has been, well, weird. In politics, pop culture, a lot of places. And Spotify, the streaming music service, decided to capitalize on that in its advertising campaign. With the tagline, "Thanks 2016, it's been weird." I regularly pass a sign on my commute that says, "Dear person who played Sorry 42 times on Valentine's Day, what did you do?" That comes from real listener data, and we reached out to the company's chief marketing officer, Seth Farbman, to talk about all this. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Okay, I need to read a couple of these billboards to you. And some of these I have actually seen on my commute. Dear person who made a playlist called, and I'm quoting, "One night stand with Jeb Bush like he's a Bond girl in a European casino. We have so many questions." I have a lot of questions, but from a corporate standpoint, that's real? That's somebody did that?
That's real. That's the secret to it. We aren't telling stories about Spotify. We're letting these great music fans tell stories about what music means to them. And someone created a playlist about just that topic.
What this gets at, though, is a degree of comfort with the data that you all are gathering on users. And you've been quite aggressive about this. You know, you have this whole targeting ad philosophy that you actually give to advertisers that says, you know, we can send your ads to someone who is listening late at night. Do you have a degree of, I guess I would say, acceptance among your users that, like, they're cool with that?
Oh, absolutely. And obviously, we follow all the most strict data and privacy guidelines. The truth is, if you're using data to help the music fan, to help the customer, that's a very fair exchange. If you're using data to give them information, even about another product, that's a value to them. But you cannot break that trust. Always have to have empathy and caring for the customer. And so we've done that.
Well, it's also for the good of the advertiser, obviously.
Absolutely, because advertisers should demand that their messages, their offers, are only going to people who have interest in them.
Spotify is in a very crowded landscape. You've got Apple Music, Google, iTunes. What is the thing that sets you apart? Is it this tailored use of data?
I think it's one of the things, but the data is simply an aggregation of a very large, very diverse, very engaged community of music fans. So what really sets us apart is this massive global audience that we, because of the way that they listen to music, we are able to learn more about them.
From a marketing standpoint, doing this kind of cheeky, fun ad campaign at the end of 2016 seems like it would be an awfully charming thing to do leading into a year when the company might go public. Anything to say about that?
Well, even if you're not considering that, I think it's a lovely and charming thing to do. I mean, look, this is music. This is supposed to be fun. And absolutely, we want to reinforce that we represent the best community of music fans anywhere. And however that relates to a business model can only be a good thing.
That sounds like a hint that you actually are going to do this in 2017.
Hmm. There are hints everywhere. We'll just have to see.
Seth Farbman, Chief Marketing Officer at Spotify, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for yours.
Vermont company Seventh Generation sells all sorts of home products. Laundry detergent, dishwashing soap, baby wipes, but they're made without synthetic fragrances or dyes. Back when the company started in 1988, the idea of a mission-driven company was a little radical. But nowadays, big corporations want in on that game. Case in point, Unilever acquired Seventh Generation, reportedly for $600 to $700 million in cash. Kathleen Masterson of Vermont Public Radio went to find out just what a merger of company cultures might look like.
Seventh Generation brand manager John Moorhead remembers the day everyone learned about the merger. He knew something was up when he saw an invitation to an all-staff meeting pop up on his calendar on short notice.
So I think going into the room, we were all probably a little nervous because there were more people with suits than we were used to seeing here.
Moorhead says it was very quiet in the room when the suits made the announcement. But both the Unilever reps and Seventh Generation leadership assured employees that the company would retain its core culture and mission. In many ways, the companies couldn't be more different. The Seventh Generation office has a tight-knit family feel.
What's spinning in the speaker? Can I
have? Laundry detergent.
The lab techs keep a photo of an orangutan posted on the wall as a reminder of why they use sustainably harvested palm oil. Unilever is a British-Dutch multinational corporation that owns more than 400 brands. The list includes Dove soaps, Axe body spray, Hellmann's, and Lipton tea. Unilever didn't respond to requests for an interview. But Seventh Generation CEO John Replogle says he's excited.
Seventh Generation is really accessing and leveraging the global platforms of Unilever so we can scale, so we can have more impact, so we can reach more consumers. We're moving from serving millions to hopefully one day serving billions of consumers around the world.
Replogle actually worked for Unilever for 2.5 years, managing the skincare products division. Now, back at the homegrown Vermont business, he'll help oversee the purchase of this 170-person company by a 170,000-person company. Yet Replogle says the negotiated contract was clear.
We're going to remain a Vermont company. We're going to remain a semi-independent entity of Unilever. And importantly, we're establishing a social mission board.
Replogle points to Ben & Jerry's. Its growing pains helped form a sort of template for this kind of acquisition. Back in 2000, the giant Unilever purchased the oddball, mission-driven Vermont ice cream company. And that acquisition was not easy for either party.
It is no secret that there were a few years after the acquisition that were rough years.
That's Chris Miller, the social activism manager at Ben & Jerry's, who worked for the company through the rocky transition.
I think any time you take two different companies, particularly in this case with profoundly different cultures, and try to pull them together, history has shown that those kinds of mergers don't always go particularly smooth.
He says that the relationship between Ben & Jerry's and Unilever evolved into a thriving partnership. Ben & Jerry's has retained a good deal of autonomy, not just its dog-friendly offices with an indoor slide, but also the freedom to endorse social activism movements like Black Lives Matter. But some people back at Seventh Generation still have questions, like the company's mission and advocacy manager, Ashley Orgain. She says she's confident that her social mission work will continue. Still, she says there is some romance lost.
I don't know yet how it's going to feel, but I know I'm not working for a small Vermont-based business. I'm now working for a large multinational corporation, and that's going to come with some compromises, no doubt.
For Unilever, on the other hand, the acquisition will expand the European company's foothold in green home care products and give it a competitive edge in the United States market, where its main rival is Procter & Gamble. In Burlington, Vermont, I'm Kathleen Masterson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The price of cocoa is not only set in British pound, it's also set in euro, which is a good thing.
Brexit, Brits, and their beloved chocolate. What happens now? But first, let's do the numbers. Markets in the U.S. are closed today, as are most markets overseas, for the observance of the Christmas holiday. So we glide on over to the slopes for our numbers, along with those who spend their winter holidays heading out to play in the snow. There are 463 ski resorts in the U.S. That's according to the National Ski Areas Association, a trade group. Direct spending at those resorts for things like lift tickets, food, rentals, was $7.1 billion in the 2014-15 season. If you prefer to travel along snowy trails in a motorized vehicle, well, there are figures for that, too. This past year, companies that sell snowmobiles sold more than 126,000 machines. Average age of a snowmobiler, 42. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Every now and then, we like to turn the mic over to you and answer your questions about the economy. It's a series we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's subject is hops. You know, the little flowers that give your beer that bitter flavor? If you're partial to IPAs, you know what I mean. Kai Rizdahl loves them. Me, I'm not really an IPA person. But our question comes from David Crawley of San Jose, California.
I've always wondered how the price of hops gets set, how it's bought, sold, and traded before it's turned into beer.
We sent Robert Garova to figure it out.
Jeremy Robb is co-owner of Los Angeles-based Eagle Rock Brewery. One of his seasonal beers is called the Milo Oatmeal Pale Ale, named after his toddler, Milo. The beer is made with El Dorado hops, which give it a sweet tropical aroma. Rob looks up the price for El Dorados.
So we're averaging about $9.90 a pound.
Rob says he can spend upwards of $35 per barrel on hops, and they're easily the most expensive ingredient he uses in the brew process. So why $9.90 a pound? Thomas Marsh is a professor at Washington State University. He studies the hop market and says the USDA does provide some data, but pricing is hard to nail down.
The only real public available consistent price is that one from USDA once a year. But again, that's a weighted average. It really doesn't tell us much what's going on with a particular variety.
Hops are different than wheat or sugar because there isn't a public exchange where growers, brewers, and middlemen called merchants can go to get set pricing information. Individual brewers pay different prices. Ann George is executive director of Hop Growers of America. That's a group that promotes American-grown hops.
So just to give you an example, I met with some growers in the South Atlantic region last year. They are selling their fresh hops during harvest for $15 a pound. And the comparable hops coming out of the Northwest to those brewers are running about $6 a pound.
And that's why brewers have contracts with merchants. Professor Marsh explains.
The contracting mechanisms that put in place really kind of reduce the volatility in price.
The price brewers pay per pound is private information. And Marsh says they arrive at a figure partly based on closed-door networking between other brewers. Back at Eagle Rock Brewery, Jeremy Robb shows me his contract with the hops merchant.
For 2016 crop year, we're contracted for $85,000 for the year.
That's enough hops for about 77,000 gallons of beer, in case you're wondering. And the internet is changing things. Robb says online hop exchanges are sprouting up, so you can see the price other brewers are paying. I'm Robert Garova for Marketplace.
This summer's Brexit vote has impacts far beyond the UK and Europe. Take, for example, in Ivory Coast. More than half of that country's cocoa beans go to Europe, and the British are among the biggest consumers of chocolate in the world. So here's the thing. If you're Ivory Coast, is it better to cut a separate trade deal with the UK rather than keep the one with Europe? The BBC's Didi Akinyelur reports.
If you've ever eaten a bar of chocolate, the chances are the cocoa in it came from here in Ivory Coast. The West African nation is the world's largest producer. The cocoa pods are cut from the tree, then cracked open, and the beans are plucked out and fermented. They are taken out from the forest to the villages, where they are laid out in the sun and dried. I'm in a huge warehouse where the cocoa beans are being stored in sacks. There are 12,000 tons piled on top of each other, up to the ceiling, ready for export. One of Ivory Coast's major exporters is Ali Lakis. Brexit has made life difficult for businessmen like him.
We are not interested in selling cocoa to the UK because it would be in pound sterling. But if by some miracle the pound goes back to what it was, then yes, why not sell them cocoa? But for now, it's not an option.
Despite Ali's reservations, trade experts believe that there are opportunities to be explored. Kadi Fadika Koulibaly is one of them.
In the short term, we've seen the price of cocoa falling, but now we can also see that the price of cocoa is not only set in British pound, it's also set in euro, which is a good thing. On the other side, when we look at the consumer of chocolate, UK is the fourth largest consumer in the world, so it would be silly for Côte d'Ivoire not to enter into direct trade agreement with the UK in order to control some of that demand that is coming from the UK. So Brexit will give us that opportunity to renegotiate trade agreement with the UK.
This port in Abidjan is a key hub for exports in West Africa. Trade is vital to the growth of the Ivorian economy, and the Minister of Commerce, Jean-Louis Billon, hopes that Brexit will open up new opportunities for his country.
We have there an opportunity
for African countries and the UK to renegotiate a new trade agreement. Britain being out of the European Union, we can probably negotiate what was left over with the European trade agreement with Africa. So it is something we can work on.
We're here in Abidjan, a mini chocolate factory owned by entrepreneur Olga Yenu. Olga gets her cocoa beans from farms in San Pedro, and then she grinds them there in her factory, and she then brings the cocoa powder to Abidjan, where it's packaged into one-cup sachets.
This is our bestseller. Yes. It is cocoa powder, natural cocoa powder.
To encourage the export of finished products like these sachets, the Ivorian government provided tax incentives, and Olga was quick to take advantage by opening her own shop, which I visited.
Yes.
There's chocolate all around me. We have chocolate powder. We have some chocolates that's, it's like a chocolate spread. It has cashew nuts inside. Very yummy. After 4 years, the business has still not made any profit. But Olga is hopeful that new opportunities can be found.
Selling directly to the UK, now, for example, there is no tax when I export final products. And if I sell directly for the final customer in UK, I will pay only the transport, not go to another country and come back. It is good for me. I will be able to make attractive price on very high quality product.
Brexit will change Britain's relationship with the whole world. That change could be positive for Africa, and in particular, the land of chocolate.
That's Didi Akinyuler from the BBC. This final note before we leave you today. We talked earlier on the show about how this was, in Spotify's terms, a weird year, and not one that too many of us felt great about, apparently. About a third of Americans in a recent poll said things were worse for the country in 2016 than they had been a year before. The numbers come from the Associated Press and the Times Square Alliance. Those are the ball drop people. Only 18% of people surveyed said things got better for the country this year. But hey, we are an optimistic nation, it seems. 55% of people think 2017 will be better for them personally. All right, that's it. We're out of here. Markets were closed today for the holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdal. We'll be back here tomorrow. See you then. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.